Tying these coccinellids to communities leads to a net disruption of aphid control due to integral predation. And why is that? I think a nice test case where we can sort of see how this might work is some of the work from Colfer and Rosenheim, it's Ecologia paper from 2001. They were working in a system of cotton with the aphid pest. Here is cotton aphid. Looking at Hippodamia convergence as sort of the top interguild predator, generalist predator, and also an aphid parasitoid. And what they found was that interguild predation of the parasitoid by Hippodamia was very high. Up to nearly 100% of the aphid mummies could be consumed by Hippodamia, but they found no disruption of control when they're adding Hippodamia to the communities. The most effective control community included Hippodamia. This is because Hippodamia also eats tons and tons of aphids. So while they're eating many of the parasitoid mummies are also eating very many of the aphids, there's no change in percent parasitism, and there's an improvement of control when you have Hippodamia also in the community. Rosenheim and Harmon also followed up with a meta-analysis looking at a whole wide diversity of studies and found that this generally seems to be the case, that adding integral predators generally improves control. So there is, of course, there's some disruption beyond sort of an ideal case if there was no interference, but still there's a net improvement of control when adding in these integral predators. Okay, so that's kind of caveat number one, is that integral predation does not necessarily mean that biocontrol is going to be entirely disrupted. Caveat number two is that many of these interguild prey are not just sort of sitting there waiting to die. They actually take an active role in trying to avoid interguild predators. Again, many of these examples involve coccinella. Let's just take this example from Taylor et al. They're looking at A. ervi as the interguild prey, and C7 was the interguild predator. What they found is that the A. ervi would greatly reduce their foraging time on plants that either actually housed the C7 or that had previously housed the C7. So there apparently is some kind of a chemical cue that the parasitoid can recognize. When they pick up the presence of the interguild predator, they just go forage somewhere else. So it's a way to reduce some of the negative effects of integral predation by avoiding being eaten. Oops, skipped a little bit ahead. And finally, although we spent a lot of time looking at negative interactions amongst predators, there are some examples in the literature where there actually are positive interactions between predators. Kind of the classic example of this is from Losi and Deno, work in alfalfa with P. aphid. The two predators they were looking at were C7, which forage up in the foliage, and Harpalus pennsylvanicus and some other ground beetles that forage on the ground. So the issue here is that Harpalus, some of the other ground beetles are very voracious aphid predators, but they almost never encounter them because, of course, the aphids are up in the plants. That is, unless C7 is also foraging. So when C7 is foraging, as I'm sure many of you have seen, P. aphids will drop from the plants. Once they drop onto the ground, then they're available as prey to the ground beetles. So this leads to what's called a synergism, where the combined impact of these two natural enemies is greater than what you would predict based on any one of the natural enemies' individual impacts. So it's sort of an example of the rock and the hard place kind of an idea, where the aphids are trying to jump out of the plants to escape from C7, and then they get hit by the ground beetles on the ground. Okay, so just concluding from some of these studies in the literature, we see again that integral predation is very common among coccinellids, and indeed in many communities, including generalist predators. But IGP may be important in sort of the structure of communities in the course of coccinellid invasions. But in studies so far, particularly within coccinella communities, rarely do we see really strong disruption of aphid control due to this integral predation. And probably what we need to do is maybe put a little more attention now into looking at some of the positive interactions among natural enemies that might improve control, which have gotten a little bit less attention in the last few years. Sort of what's really been a limitation of all the studies in the past with these sort of typical additive type designs is that it's hard to deal with a lot of species. The treatment numbers become really, really large, and so you tend to be looking at just a small subset of the species in the community. Sort of leaves the question, well, sort of overall, amongst all the species in the community, what are the interactions like? Mostly positive or mostly negative? So what I'm going to do now is just talk about some of our own work where we're trying to deal with more diverse species communities. So what we've been trying to do is borrow some of the experimental approaches from the biodiversity and ecosystem functioning literature. This is sort of a big emerging field over the last few years. People are interested in the sort of global mass extinction that's going on due to human effects, and try to understand, is there some value to species richness per se? Can we isolate the effect of species richness on some ecosystem function that's of interest? So here we're working with predators. So in the figure here I have increasing natural enemy diversity across the x-axis. And on the y-axis is the strength of herbivore regulation. So this is sort of the ecosystem function that we're probably most interested in when we're dealing with natural enemy communities. And what's nice is there are some mechanisms that have been discussed in this biodiversity ecosystem functioning literature that maybe we can adapt and use in predator-prey systems. And the most common result in these studies has been what we see with the blue line, where you see an improvement in function, for example, like primary productivity in plant systems. The way this mechanism that's supposed to underlie these results, or is thought to, is that there's complementarity among species. So when you have species that are using the resource in subtly different ways, you're going to have the most complete resource use when you have multiple species together. So basically, the consumers are occupying different niches, and so they can most completely exploit the resource when they're together. Of course, with predator communities, we know there's also another possibility that we could have declining functioning, or in this case, herbivore regulation due to integral predation, as I've already discussed. So it's kind of a different wrinkle in predator communities. And then I showed, just for completeness, the green line. Of course, there could be no effect of diversity. If the predators all do the same thing, then having diversity, is greater diversity, isn't going to make a difference, as long as you're keeping density the same. Okay, this is the community that we've been working on. The collards are sort of our basal resource. Then we have two aphid species. The green peach aphid on the left and the cabbage aphid on the right are common collared pests in Washington. Now we have quite a diverse community of natural enemies that attacks these two species of aphid. And this is sort of the species pool that we're working with for our studies. We have an aphid parasitoid, D. rapi. Two lady beetles are particularly common, C7 and Hippodamia convergens. And then we also have two species of generalist bug predators, big-eyed bugs, Geocorus, and damsel bugs, Nabis. So remember, to see improving control with greater diversity, we would need to have some sort of niche differences, and I think it's pretty obvious to everyone that these natural enemies, you know, hunt in different ways, are different sizes, have different sort of approaches to catching prey and so on, that might provide some of this niche differences that could lead to improved control. But we also know that integral predation commonly occurs in this community. So for example, most of the predators don't care if they're eating an aphid or a parasitized aphid. Many will feed on mummies, the ladybird beetles will feed on one another's eggs and larvae, and Geocorus and Nabis, the big ones, eat the little ones. So lots of chance for negative effect of diversity as well. So the central questions that we're looking at then is, first of all, does aphid control strengthen or weaken with greater net natural enemy biodiversity? Second of all, does natural enemy performance differ in single species versus diverse communities? So here we're just looking for evidence of integral predation or negative interactions, or in turn positive effects. And if we do see a pattern one way or the other, why does this occur? What is the mechanism? So I'm going to kind of go through these one by one. But I guess at first I'm going to talk about the experiment. It's probably a good idea. Okay, so biodiversity ecosystem functioning designs are a little different than the sort of additive designs that are typically used in predator-prey studies. And we adopted this approach. So our treatments are levels of species richness. So what we're varying in our treatments is the number of species present, but we're not changing the total abundance of natural enemies. So it's a way to isolate the effect of diversity per se. I've already shown you our species pool that we're going to draw our communities from. And we use multiple species compositions at low versus high diversity levels. This is just to make sure that any effect that we see is due to diversity per se rather than the interactions among particular groups of species. Okay, our experimental design is, we had sort of three main treatments. We had a no predator control. Then we had low diversity monocultures, and this is each of the five natural enemy species by itself, just a single species. We had three replicates of each of those. And then we had diverse communities. There are five unique compositions. Within the diverse communities, we had four species of natural enemy present. There are four unique compositions of four natural enemy species from our pool of five, which is just each natural enemy species deleted. And we kept the density the same across both of these treatments, so we're manipulating diversity only and not also density. Our experimental units were these large 2x2x2 meter cages, each housing 8 collared plants. We put the aphids on the plants. We released the predators, again, within the substitutive design at a constant density. And we follow aphid dynamics through time. At the end, we collect predators to see how they were influenced by the treatments as well. The experiment ran for 28 days, and this is long enough for all the natural enemies to reproduce. It's about two parasitoid generations, and for the coccinellids and some of the predatory bugs, they were sort of late-stage nymphs or larvae. Okay, this is what our experimental site looked like. So lots and lots of cages. Good thing I put this in there to remind me to Oh, there's Gretchen right there. To thank Gretchen and Debbie Finke. Gretchen's a PhD student in the lab, and Debbie was a postdoc. They're the people that did really a lot of this work that I'm taking credit for up here. Okay, so here are the data. So what I'm showing is the two aphid species separately. So on the left are the data for green peach aphid. On the right are the data for cabbage aphid. On the x-axis, we're tracking the number of days. And on the y-axis, it's aphid densities. And then we have our three treatments. The dotted line is the no predator control. The sort of blue triangles there are the monocultures. Well, it's a lot harder to do this and just point it out. And then the pink line, sort of the pink triangles, I guess, are the more diverse communities. So what you can see is, first of all, the natural enemies clearly suppress the aphids, so you have lower aphid densities when predators are present. But what's really distinct, to note that this is actually on a log scale, is that aphid control was much stronger when you have diverse than monospecific communities. So really strong evidence with really good and strong statistical support that aphid control was much stronger in the presence of diverse than simple communities of aphid predators. And that was the same for both aphid species. Okay, so what's happening whenever more aphids are being eaten, obviously, is that predators are getting more aphids into their bellies. So you would expect that you would see generally improved predator performance when they're in diverse communities. And indeed, that did seem to be the case for the most part. On the left, I'm showing the data for the predators. So this is the bugs and the beetles. And then on the right, I'm showing separately the data for the parasitoid. And what we saw for both the adults and the juveniles that were produced in these cages was improved survivorship to the end of the experiment in diverse communities than in monocultures. Things are a little more complicated with the juveniles. To get a sort of a significant effect of diversity, you have to include aphid densities as a covariate, because we had some polycultures that were so effective at killing the aphids that there were almost no aphids left. And then, of course, the predators do pretty poorly when there's no prey. But generally, predators did better in polyculture, except for the parasitoid, which seemed to show no difference in its performance between low and high diversity treatments. So generally positive or no effects on predators. Okay, so sort of the last question that we wanted to get at then is why? Why is this happening? And the student in the lab that sort of took the first shot at this was Corey Straub. So we've done all these kind of big experiments where you throw predators in there and then you count aphids. We never really took the time to just sit down and watch all the predators to see what they're doing. And Corey took on this thankless task, I guess so that he could graduate and finish his dissertation and all that kind of stuff. He set up little arenas that had plants and predators, communities, sort of reproducing the field experiment in these greenhouse aquarium microcosms, and he just sat and watched them. So what he was looking for here is to see if there are some differences in behavior, how they're moving through the environment that might allow them to complement one another in aphid control. And specifically, he was interested in whether or not the predators were using different parts of the plant so that there was some sort of niche differences in plant space use that could lead to the complementarity that we seem to see from the field results. Okay, so this is sort of a complicated figure, so let me take a minute to describe it. Corey sort of divided up the collard plant into three main regions. There was the leaf core, which is showing here in sort of dark green. So that's the center of the leaf, anything that's not the edge, and the edge is anything within 2 centimeters of the edge of the leaf. And then finally, stems was the last part of the plant that they might be using. Then we have, first of all, the total, which we can sort of ignore. Then we have the results for aphidius. This is actually using a different parasitoid than the other work, but that's sort of a whole other story. Aphidius, then nabis, then coccinella, and then hippodamia. And what we saw was that when we look at aphidius and nabis, those two species are very good at accessing the core of the leaf, whereas the two ladybird beetles are almost entirely restricted to the edges of the leaves. These are very waxy leaves, and it's probably just not possible for them to adhere very well to the leaves, so they're kind of stuck at the edges. So we do have this really clear difference in space use between some natural enemies that can use the core of the leaf versus other at the edge, others are at the edge of the leaf. And, how much time do I have? 2 minutes. Okay. It's the last slide, so that's probably good. Almost the last slide. So what we think is happening is that the lady beetles are the most voracious predators, but they're restricted to the edge of the leaf. The other predators are less voracious but can access the center of the leaf. So only when you have both coccinellids and some of the other predators do you have control of aphids across the entire plant structure. Okay, just to summarize real quick, so if greater natural enemy diversity led to stronger aphid suppression, predators did better, parasitoids did no better, and complementary space use among natural enemies could be one of the reasons that we're seeing improved control of aphids with greater diversity in this system. So generally, and just to summarize, generally positive effects of diversity in this community. Sort of an overall conclusion, We know that negative predator-predator interactions certainly happened and it received a lot of attention, but I would argue it might be worthwhile to spend some more time trying to look at some of these positive predator-predator effects that could lead to improved control. And thanks, everybody, for your attention. Oh, and funding by USDA NRI. I must always say that.
Have time for a couple of questions?
Yeah, Moshe. Right.
So you're counting the figures as one and C7 as one. So is there a way to weigh differently according to the impact on aged population? What would that be?
So we haven't tried that. So Moshe asked the question, you know, obviously these predators are really different and one parasitoid is not likely to be the same as one ladybird beetle. It's been sort of a practical reason. In some early experiments, we tried to adjust it based on the feeding rates, as you're suggesting, and we got killed by reviewers, so we stopped doing that. And we've never tried that in the collared system, so because that breaks the biodiversity ecosystem functioning orthodoxy. So that's another way of saying we don't really know because we never tried that again, but it could be interesting. Yes?
I didn't catch what the mechanism was by which predators did better in the presence of other predators.
Yeah, it's sort of a complex thing. So when you have sort of a lot of predators of the same species, they're all basically competing on the same parts of the plants. So we're not talking about sort of a direct sort of interaction, is sort of a more of an indirect effect of diversity. So when you have a lot of competition, that's less food for you, and so you do more poorly, is what we think is happening. But when you're in a diverse community, you're with, you know, other predators that are feeding in different parts of the plants or doing something different. So there's sort of like this more total prey available because of the niche differences, so lower competition.
It's not a benefit, but it's more an absence of cost.
That's exactly right. So intra-Pacific competition is really strong, and inter-Pacific competition is relatively weak. Thanks.
And I'll be talking about a little bit of the non-prey foods of coccinellids. Usually, predator ecologists tend to focus on predation by natural enemies. This is understandable, since this is one of the real functions that we're trying to get out of our natural enemies. In reality, many natural enemies, if not most, are facultatively phytophagous to some degree, or at least consume non-prey foods at some point during their lives. This type of feeding has really important implications for their natural histories, and coccinellids are no exceptions to that. So I guess that the goal of this talk is to sort of introduce these different non-prey foods, which coccinellids from the literature have been feeding on them, and the importance of this type of feeding for the life history of these beetles. Also, I should mention that I'm focusing mostly on the predaceous species of these coccinellids. As Natalia mentioned earlier, there's also phytophagous, purely phytophagous, and as you'll hear next, there's also purely mycophagous species. So we've known that coccinellids are omnivores for a long time. I think maybe not the first report of omnivory in coccinellidae, but certainly one of the best early reports was done by Stephen Forbes back in Illinois in the 1800s. What he did basically was pull the stomachs out of these ladies.